I'm Jimmy, the EMS Avenger. This is the EMS Avenger podcast, and I am here with Dr. Ben Abo.
Exactly. Got it right.
Dr. Ben Abo, he is a physician. And give me a little bit of your background here and what you do.
So I'm a full-time EMS physician and still paramedic, kind of spanning around all different places in Florida, from Naples, Pine Island, Sanibel the Islands, Bonita Springs, and McGregor. I also the city of Gainesville, and now also medical director for Escambia County, all of public safety.
Okay.
Also seen around TV stuff, but basically I'm addicted to EMS for the past 28 years.
I share your addiction. We see you pop up a lot in any sort of like national disaster or incident. There seems to be a desire to get you to have some sort of influence in, or at least some sort of physician referenced summarization of events. And I also see your influence in envenomation type of discussions, something that I'm also interested in as well.
Yeah.
Spencer Green's brain quite often.
Yeah, I'm proudly a medical director for the Venom 1 Venom Response Unit. I do a lot of wilderness medicine, so I do a lot with IBSC as one of the physicians there and one of the creators for WPC. And that's what initially also brought me on board as one of the medical directors for Foam Frat, with the all the educational, the environmental kind of stuff as well. And yeah, one of my many babies also is the Miami-Dade Task Force 1, Florida Task Force 1 and Task Force 6 more locally for disasters for urban search and rescue.
Awesome. Well, your influence into EMS medicine is particularly relevant now because of a paper that just came out. But before we get into that paper, I just want to tell you about a case I had a day or two ago. It was a wreck. A guy had gotten into a wreck. There was airbag deployment. He had a seatbelt on. We got there and he was up and walking around. He was smiling and laughing, waving at his children, taking selfies with firefighters. And I walked up behind him and I said, "Hi." And he turned his head and then he collapsed to the ground and is paralyzed probably for life. And I just can't help but think that if I had placed a rigid cervical collar on him and put him on a rigid spine board, that I would have prevented that. And this is clearly the benefit of the rigid cervical collar and the spinal board, is preventing this case that has happened in front of thousands and thousands and thousands of providers.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. The collars, it's like decaf coffee. There's a time and place for them, never and in the trash. collars are a cancer. I mean, they really are. The notion of spinal immobilization, collars, backboards, is not based on science. And the idea that they prevent further injury or prevent or do any good, has just invaded medicine without anything, just like a cancer kind of invades and kind of spreads. It's an old school dogma. Again, not based on science.
It's good intentions. Solution in search of a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is not based on science, and it's just invaded everything and is has got to go. So that dogma and status quo, we need to be gone, and that needs true dogmolysis. I mean, it goes back to the history of initially based on a couple of assumptions. You know, it was good intentions, but Geisinger and others put out a paper back in 1966, just based on some observations, had a couple of patients that were moving all four extremities and within a couple of hours were paralyzed. And it was just hypothesized that maybe It was because they're manhandled by pre-hospital care and moving around, and we need to, put their curved back on these rigid boards, and it just went from there. Everything was based on that. You look at the old textbooks, Nancy Caroline Care in the Streets, and all this stuff, just referring to this one thing that was very based on just complete assumptions. It's the making assumptions makes an ass out of you, assumptions is what I like to say. It's
Sure.
ridiculous.
What's interesting to see is how, excuse me, every component that is peripheral to spinal immobilization, we have removed. I mean, initially, after these case studies, we were removing people from patients with winches and pulleys. The winch and pulley removal is gone. The standing takedown is gone. The rigid spine board itself and the term spinal immobilization actually is kind of out of date, and we use the term spinal motion restriction, but we cannot get rid of that freaking collar.
It's interesting. We almost shot ourselves in the foot when we started re-looking at the data, and came up with spinal motion restriction. But when we really started doing the deep dive into that, even that's just made sense. We tried to study it. And I'm just really proud of with great leadership like Dr. Ling and Dr. Millen and just NMSP. It was a very rigorous scientific process that we really looked at everything. Like we read all these articles, everything, trying to find is there benefit, what are the harms, blah 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 blah, and categorize it. And there was nothing, zero. There were zero
So
studies.
what you're referring to is actually this paper that was just published, and it is a systematic review and meta-analysis, or it's a comprehensive review and analysis on essentially all the data that you could find from the NAEMSP Trauma Compendium series. And so you guys screened almost 4,000 papers just looking, just show me something that tells me that there's a benefit to spinal mobilization, to spinal motion restriction, to the vacuum splint, to the rigid cervical collar. Just show me anything. And the result was.
A preposterous no, nothing. And and it's like the thought was maybe they might help, but we can't find any proof that there's any benefit, but we found plenty of proof that there is harm.
Yes, it looks like you identified at least 55 studies, which is exactly 55 more studies than the studies that demonstrated benefit.
Yes, we had a bunch of experts in true scientific, pure form, go through. We read all the studies. We had multiple people look at the studies. What were the outcomes? Was it strong? Was it not, good evidence one way or another? We were looking for, and you can see from the charts that are in there, we list, were there ones that showed benefit, right? Looking, and then was there anything that proved that there was benefit or what caused the later injuries? And a lot of it actually pointed to hypoperfusion of the cord, not movement, hypoperfusion of the cord, right? And then edema
Right.
and things like that. So what was the science behind the later, injuries? And trying to find any benefit, couldn't find any. In fact, a lot of the studies pointed that there was actually more movement when you put these collars on, whether it's a hard collar or a soft collar, there's actually more movement, which, hello, like, come on, right? And then there's multiple harms from pressure sores, lack of movement, more pain, more imaging, more procedures, higher costs, pressure on the carotids, increased intracranial pressure. All these things lead to more issues. So why am I going to do something that's proven to cause more harm?
Sure. And a lot of people will bring up the parachute paradox that says, well, we can't actually do an RCT. You know, how can we actually, like, comparing it to we can't do a study on whether a parachute saves lives because if we don't have the parachute, everyone will die. And to me, it's an absurd statement to make because there are countries all over the world and regions in the US that don't use rigid cervical collars and they don't
The
have worse
UK is
outcomes.
not used used backboards and stuff for over 10 years.
Yeah, and they're not a nation of quadriplegics.
Yeah, no, they're walking around, walking around. Right?
Yeah.
And it's pretty interesting. And by the way, you brought up the parachute. Have you ever talked to your listeners where the parachute paradox came from, that paper?
Well, I know that there is a paper that actually studied, kind of, sarcastically the
Yeah, it
incidents.
was great. It was a randomized controlled trial of do are parachutes needed to save lives or prevent death when jumping out of a plane? And 100% of the people that jumped out of the plane, I mean, they did legit research. 100% of the people that jumped out of the plane survived. So you don't need parachutes. The fact of the matter was that the plane was on the ground. And so that's why when people talk about headlines and this and that, you need to really look at the studies, right? And does it make sense? Is it scientifically sound in the process? And when you look at scientific strength, if you look up, and this is something you should kind of overlay, I'm telling you should overlay that pyramid of the strength of scientific evidence. What's above RCT?
Systematic reviews and
Meta-analyses is at the
meta-analyses.
top. Yeah. And so guess what? That's what we did. So this is stronger than an
You presented the
RCT.
highest quality evidence that you could provide.
Yeah, we looked at all the strengths and this and that, and we showed, that's so no, we're not going to do an RCT. It would be ridiculous too.
So, why aren't trauma surgeons on board with this?
More and more are finally coming to the table to look at it. What I've witnessed a lot of, and I won't say it's 100%, but I've seen people just refuse to discuss the data. There are a lot of people that are stuck in their ways of how they trained and hashtag status quo. This is how it's always been. We've always done it this way. And if you want to actually practice up-to-date, evidence-driven, evidence-based medicine, then you'll be willing to look at the data. And we are now at that point where, and that's what happened when we did the spinal motion restriction in the 20 teens. And this paper is officially a resource document from NMSP and is finally a thing that a number of trauma surgeons and neurosurgeons are willing to look at so we can have that discussion. I am very happy that about a year and a half ago, Southwest Florida, our trauma surgeon said, yeah, we can do away with transporting on boards. And I was like, woohoo, we're getting somewhere. And we've really minimalized collars, or minimized collars, sorry. And up in Escambia County, I'm saving an average of $52,000 a year on collars. Not to mention, I'm saving patients from further harm
I think you have
by getting
EMS's
rid of
attention now.
collars. What's that?
I think you have EMS's attention now.
Yeah, we finally have it. There are people listening, and that's
With
only
saving
one.
money.
You can go ahead. That's exactly it. Yeah, you can go ahead and say, well, I'm not sure this or that. But you have to be willing to listen and talk. That's what I'm asking for. Not just screw status quo is one of my favorite lines, right? You have to be willing to do it. And anyone that refuses to talk about and stuck in the dogmasis or uses the fear of litigation, which that also is ridiculous because I could easily, especially this paper, prove to you things like, oh, there aren't any cases that set precedents that you didn't use a collar, therefore you're in trouble. So that's preposterous. And I question the skills and the knowledge of someone that refuses to talk about the evidence.
I think it's kind of a retreat to a safe space in those discussions when you hear something like that. My experience is when attempting to have these discussions with people who have influence, or at least who have resistance to this change. I'm going to set up this conversation. Are you familiar with the show The Office? Have you ever watched The Office?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So there's an episode where we discover that Michael Scott is involved in an improv group. And anytime they do improv, he pulls out a gun and just yells gun and points it at people, and he effectively shuts down the improv. Anytime I have a conversation with somebody that has resistance to this knowledge, they pull out the person who was otherwise neurologically intact, turned their head, and then was paralyzed. It is a conversation stopper. And everyone knows someone with this story. No one ever had this patient, but it's pulled out as a
You
conversation
never know
stopper.
the guy. I'll tell you what, firsthand knowledge. I around the corner from where I'm at right now, I was at one of my fire departments, and I was at Iona McGregor Fire Department, which we're an ALS non-transport special ops heavy driven, right? And a call went out, was dispatched, and I look at the dispatch. I'm trying to figure out why automatically battalion chief was also dispatched, and so it went as a high level. It was around the corner. It was kind of moderate damage, three cars. And I go to the front. I said to the battalion chief as I pulled up, "Hey, I'm going to check the front." And he's calling for me. He's like, "Hey, doc. Hey, doc. Think you need to see this one." And the woman was like this, restrained driver. Her head's to the side like this, and she can't move her arm. Nothing else. She's like, "My neck hurts and my arm. I can't move." And so I called as a trauma alert just based on that. I'm expecting vertebral artery dissection. And spinal cord injury, and we had to be very careful. I refused to let the medics put on the collar. I said, "I'm here. We're gonna, And while I'm with her, she actually had a moment of unresponsiveness, and then, and I tried. I'm like just seeing if I could slightly ease. I'm like, "Oh, great. I'm gonna have to intubate her like this." She regains consciousness after we put an NPA in and oxygenate. We get her kind of down, position, comfort, just kind of pat around. We get to the trauma center and she's now conscious again. She can't move her arm. She's at this point slightly able to move some fingers. And I talked to her. I'm like, "Were you like this before the accident?" And she's like, "No, I was moving all around. In fact, I brought my arm over just before I was like getting ready to brace myself for the accident." She had rear-ended somebody else. And as I get into the trauma bay, I said, "Dr. Abo, I'm FDMD1. This is what we got. This is my concerns." And they listened in terms of having neurosurgery ready. They were doing the CTA and everything. And right in front of me, I am not kidding, they forced her head to be able to get a collar on. Forced. And right in front of me, like that, she threw a clot. And stroked out and had to be intubated and everything right there, right in front. And I talked to one of the trauma docs later, and then and she's like, "Well, they would have needed a collar anyway at some point." And I go, because they were questioning why I didn't put a collar on in the field. I'm like, "She's symptomatic and the head's kind of stuck like this. I can't move. It's, a structural barrier, position of comfort, et cetera." She's like, "Yeah, but she would have needed a collar anyway." I'm like, "You can put a collar on under Flora with a properly sized collar, like the expensive Philadelphia, not Philadelphia, Aspens or Miami Jade. Those are very expensive and they're specifically sized. That's different when you have things that you can then stent and do it under fluoro, right?" And again, they're like, "Yeah, but you should have put a collar on because she would have needed a collar sooner or later." I go, "I'm also gonna have to take a dump at some point. Do you want me to do it on the patient's stretcher or wait until an appropriate time?" And she's like, "Excuse me?" I'm like, "Show me, my birthday's coming up. Show me one study that proves where this woman would have benefited from one of our improperly sized, can't fit them, generally speaking, no neck collars, and I will shave my head."
You have a
And
nice
we
head of
all
hair, babe.
know I take my curls very seriously, right? And to this day, they still have not been able to. And I knew that there were no studies because I was already doing this research study and meta-analysis. And I truly believe that because we've always done it this way, they killed her. They killed her. They didn't intend to. I don't think that they're bad people. But we're not just trying to have good intentions. I'm trying to have good patient care for all my residents and all my visitors.
It's almost like she was sacrificed for a ritual. And it, I keep thinking about the term ritual when I think about this. How
wow.
Thinking about this differently is so disruptive to people's thinking because it's an EMS ritual. Just like transporting a patient to the hospital intra-arrest is a ritual. And what I think about is, you know, if I go to a fast food restaurant, I will try to tell that person everything they need to know. I want a hamburger with no pickles, a large fries, large drink. I want my drink to be Coke. This is to go. Okay, so is this for here or to go? And they just ask me all their questions because I disrupted their ritual. They can't process anything that
it's
I just
true.
Told them because it was so disruptive to the ritual. I will say everything that is in this study to someone, that a backboard is a utility for extricating a patient to get them on the stretcher. And they will look at you and go, well, how are we supposed to get patients out of vehicles? This is so disruptive to their ritual that they can't process any of it.
That's exactly, people need to understand what their tools are. And I'd say initially I wanted to just get rid of longboards, period. Like get them on my trucks. But number one, I have a lot of water. Or as my Jersey folks, where I'm originally from, would say water, right? We have a lot of water, and they float, and I get a lot of extrications, right? So yes, so I use the longboard as a tool, as a slide board, this and that, and kind of move them over, and then you get them off right away. I'm like, don't you dare strap someone to that backboard. Don't you dare, right? Because they need right. to get off of it right away. And the other thing, too, is that a term that I've coined out of this, when we were looking for causes of injury and further injury, and we came up with the hypoperfusion and all, is iatrogenic distracting injuries. So that's my new term out of this. We are causing, because we're concentrating so much on, I got C-spine, right? Or we got to fix this collar to do that ritual, as you speak of, that it's taking my attention and skills away from other things. Right. Or it's harder to manage an airway because I'm so worried about some cockamamie, you know, C-spine movement. Right?
Right.
And so it actually causes more harm. And that's an important aspect, but people need to get out of this ritual. I remember 24 years ago in paramedic school in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where we were going through just like an EMT class. EMT classes, man, that was 1996 or 7 in South Jersey. And you put them on the board and you put the CIDs on and you'd flip the person upside down to like you are graded. You are not a worthy EMT or paramedic if you don't fully immobilize, right? But that's, I remember those days and having the pride where you're judged on it, but really we're judged on what we do for people and what we don't do, and of in terms of what's appropriate. So we just gotta, I like that that wording you said about the, you know, ritualistic sacrifice. That puts it in.
Yeah. So the, back to the distracting injury part, that mm-hmm. is also another paradigm that needs to be reversed, because what you're saying is that your hyper focus on inconsequential or even harmful therapies are distracting you from something that is a much greater concern. Somebody who's been involved in an MVC and has no neuro deficits but a mid-shaft femur fracture, there are genuine concerns with that mid-shaft femur fracture, so you should be focusing on that to make sure that that extremity is stable. However, dogma has told us that that femur fracture is distracting you from immobilizing that patient properly, even though we have good data that demonstrates that patient can still identify specific localized pain having to do with their spinal column, even in the presence of a distracting injury. So that's another paradigm flip that needs to happen.
That I'm unfortunately, or fortunately, I'm proud of my that term, because it really made me rethink everything and how we train. I don't want to create more training scars. I want to get rid of training scars, and different things. And it's really gone into a lot in terms of airway management, overall patient care, all this. And I realize it when going through all of this. Because I would see people like, oh, I got C-spine, I gotta hold it still. No, you don't. You don't.
Yeah. What do you say to the provider who has some time and rate in EMS? I have over 20 years. You've been involved in this for maybe even longer. And we have all these providers out here that something like spinal mobilization has been a part of their lives. And now we're getting data out here that says this is just all wrong. There's actually a real type of trauma associated with them kind of attempting to dissociate from them. It's almost like an atheist deconstructing from Christianity. You know, there's a very psychologically tough process for them transitioning to that evidence-based approach to management of spinal injuries. How do you address that?
I try to have discussions with any level, with any practitioner. They have to be willing to grow. The fact is, the human body is nothing new. Patients don't read textbooks, to discern it. EMS is young, right? And so we had things again with good intentions, but we have to be willing to update and have humility in medicine. And look at all the things that are coming on. The old screw to open the jaw, stacked shocks, mass trousers, like things are going to always come and go, but we don't know what we don't know. And we have to look back and make sure what we're doing is right.
Sure.
And if they're still not willing to even have a discussion, then and to kind of grow and change based on science, then they're not welcome on my trucks.
Fair enough.
Because I am responsible for the well-being. I'm always hoping. I know that I'm not right. I'm not per all the time. I'm not perfect, but I question the type of clinician one is if you're not willing to grow and learn and prove one thing or another.
So to bring us in to close this, what we should, I would be neglectful if we didn't say, kind of speak to what we should be doing. So let's say you get a patient who's been involved in some sort of trauma. Maybe they have some slight neurodeficit or they have some pretty significant pain to the cervical spine. You have genuine concerns. What is the proper way to package and transport that patient without a backboard and a cervical collar?
Just in a position of comfort, we probably need to do slightly elevated, like 30 degrees or things like that for head injuries, but that's other things we're teasing out. But just support. If they are conscious, they are automatically supporting themselves in their head. So I'll put just a little rolled towel on either side. I'm not taping their head, but I'll just put something head just to kind of support, as we hit bumps and things like that. But that's it. Just support it. That's it. That's it. So a lot of
Okay.
times I might also just for comfort, and sometimes it might be for the comfort of the crews, but if I have a towel that's like long, like picture like Rocky, like putting the towel over his shoulders, right? And I just lay that on the stretcher and then I'll just roll it in and it's just sitting here just to provide a little bit of support. That's it. No
All right.
CIDs, definitely not a collar. Definitely not on a longboard.
How about the
And
vacuum splint?
so I one of the there are a couple benefits out of the full body vacuum splints. It fills the voids, number one. Number two, it provides a separation from the ground, so therefore you it helps with the with hypothermia prevention. With thermic regulation, it's more comfortable. And if I do use a vacuum splint, once I place them on it, I just kind of like when I'm taking the air out of it, I kind of just push up on either sides on the head, not wrapping like here, but I just elevate just a little bit so there's a little bit of a bump with it. But really, the evidence isn't necessarily there for really needing it in most cases. But if the opportunity provides, I do tend to use it because it tends to be more comfortable. It's something rigid that I can do a full body movement, and it gives them handles.
Excellent. I'm going to post the link to this study in my bio for people who are listening to this. Dr. Abo, I appreciate you coming by and talking about this. I know that you feel strongly about this, and hopefully we can start seeing the dial move in the right direction on here as far as the evidence goes.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Appreciate being had, and welcome further discussion. Again, I don't want people to be like, well, I've always done it this way. But if people want to actually have discussion, take a look at this paper, take a look at the past position statements, and see. It's a whopping, many studies that show harm and no benefit. There's zero papers that actually show benefit.
Excellent. Dr. Abo, I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.